What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Judge, please. I just can't seem to get going till later at night. You think I want to be late? Those people deserve a show.
That's Elizabeth Moss as Becky Something, the self-absorbed, self-destructive, and really just all-round destructive lead singer of a once big alt-rock trio that's fallen on hard times in the new film, Her Smell.
Alex Ross Perry, writer and director of The Color Wheel, Listen Up Philip, and 2015's Queen of Earth, specializes in cinematic depictions of terrible people. Her Smell is not an exception. This week on the show, a review of Perry's latest and the first film in our four-part Stanley Donen marathon, 1949's On the Town.
It's all ahead.
The Bronx is up and the battery's down.
On Film Spotting. Welcome to Film Spotting, and welcome back, Josh Larson. After 2 weeks of guest hosts, first you and last week me, Scott Tobias, joining me for that conversation about High Life and an interview with Claire Denis, we're back together.
It's nice
to have
back.
The usual pairing here in the studio. Nothing against Scott Tobias or Michael Phillips with you lovely people both.
Not at all. And how do you think I took the week off for singing lessons? Think I got my money's worth?
That wasn't bad, actually.
Thank you.
And I noticed how Sam wrote that part in the intro for you and not for me, sparing him and all of our listeners. You were out in Boulder, Colorado for Ebert Interruptus at the Conference on World Affairs. We will hear all about that later in the show.
Strong representation from Film Spotting Nation.
I love to hear that. But even with all of those fans out there, Josh, and commanding that stage, dissecting the Pixar film WALL-E frame by frame, could it have been more exhilarating than sharing a studio with Claire Denis, who, by the way, because you haven't listened to the interview yet, I know, because you haven't seen High Life yet.
That's right.
You haven't heard the part where she proclaims The Life Aquatic by Steve Zissou to be one of her favorite movies.
Which you texted me while I was away.
Yeah, that's true.
And it warmed my heart to hear that.
Yeah.
So glad.
I
what great taste Denis has.
I knew you'd appreciate it. On this week's show, we are going to kick off our Stanley Donen marathon with the 1949 musical On the Town, starring Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra, though they might take a back seat in this film, actually, despite all that star power to the women in that film we will discuss a bit later.
But first, our review of Her Smell, which I'm convinced was given that title in something of a punk rock move to lead to just that sort of awkward phrasing.
Becky's on the, she's a woman. She's a user. Her mother, she's a deadbeat, a person, a persona.
No, you're a mess.
Josh, in your first impression tweet about Her Smell, Alex Ross Perry's sixth feature, you wrote, Elizabeth Moss goes full Jenna Rollins, which I recognized immediately as a direct comparison to Rollins' towering turn as manic housewife Mabel in John Cassavetes' A Woman Under the Influence. The film got my vote for Best Picture of our recently completed Cassavetes marathon, but was the only film of the four we discussed to not get a full-on positive review from you. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate.
Okay. And Mabel, not Roland's performance, but Cassavetes' depiction, was the primary culprit. Despite being the centerpiece of the film, you suggested Cassavetes didn't give her the same sense of dignity that he gave to Mabel's husband, Nick, played by Peter Falk. Dignity might be a fruitful place to start our conversation about Her Smell, which stars Moss as Becky Something, a Courtney Love-esque leader of a 90s all-woman alt-rock trio on the downslope of her career, a reality she almost surely recognizes but aggressively refuses to fully accept, her denial aided by too much drugs, booze, and ego. Post-performance, she stalks the rooms and halls backstage, brushing off and berating everyone who legitimately cares about her or is supported by her, or both. This includes her ex-lover, played by Dan Stevens, and the infant daughter he takes care of. Later in the studio, what does she do when, barely coherent enough to strum her guitar, she's confronted by a younger, cuter, catchier version of her band, Something She? She talks eagerly, if desperately, to her acolytes about collaboration, doing something fresh, trying the new sound the kids are into, all with one clear objective: total annihilation. Becky's brand of maniacal self-destruction, unlike Mabel's, brings with it vomit, blood, and even handcuffs. Dignity? Not so much. But Cassavetes and Perry, similar as they may be, their indie aesthetics favoring long takes and close-ups and a heavy dose of handheld cameras, are different artists on different missions. In Her Smell, Perry is interested in something I don't recall seeing in our Cassavetes viewings: release, and, however messy and complicated, redemption. Does that distinction, for you, ultimately benefit Her Smell and Moss's performance?
Man, is it something to watch this in the wake of our Cassavetes marathon? Because
There
are distinctions, as you just suggested, for sure. But those films are such an influence, have to be such an influence on Alex Ross Perry for all the reasons you just elucidated. I think that's right. And I certainly appreciated the film more, I think, in the wake of those, and appreciated Moss's performance more. Though I think we're both on record for being huge fans of hers. For me, particularly going all the way back to Mad Men and just kind of waiting for a performance that I think she's been as good in other films, but maybe hasn't had quite this volcanic element that she brings here, in addition to those quieter asides I've always admired.
A little bit in Queen of Earth.
Yeah, a little bit there. We'll get to her performance and spend more time on it. But back to that original question, I think you could probably say, and again, very briefly, what held me back about A Woman Under the Influence was more the employment of Roland's performance than the performance itself. I think you could say that the first half of Her Smell is essentially A Woman Under the Influence. It takes a very intriguing shift and gives us something closer to opening night. And my initial comment could be read sort of two ways. Full Jenna Rollins, and I don't really know how I meant it. I think I meant it both ways. Full Jenna Rollins could mean she's going for the jugular as much as Rollins does in A Woman Under the Influence.
Yes.
And I admired that.
Mm-hmm.
And I admire it here. But it also could mean she's full Jenna Rollins in that she's showing us that there are other sides to the character than the mania. Then, and I wouldn't call Mabel selfish necessarily.
No.
But then this rock bottom vision we're getting.
Yes.
We get a lot of rock bottom of Becky, a ton of it. And I was asking myself, if this is going to be the whole movie, I'm in a very similar place because I'm enthralled with the performance, admired by the achievement. But wow.
Yeah, I kind of wanted it to. In a punk rock way.
Of course.
I kind of wanted it to just
and
keep
that's
going
another way,
just full throttle.
And that's another way to admire A Woman Under the Influence, right? It chose its lane and drove through the wall. Here, I did like that we got these other layers, and it did remind me more of Myrtle, the character in Opening Night. We get a mirror scene here, right? With Becky looking at herself in the mirror and just in utter pitilessness directed towards herself. There are shades. It's different from what Myrtle does. But I think in the acting element, in the ability to convey so much without dialogue, filmmaking has a lot to do with it too. Really impressed by Perry's advance as a filmmaker with this movie. So that comes into it too. But that is a moment where you're like, wow, Moss, which I would not have been shocked if anyone had made this claim earlier, like Moss can do what Rollins did, which throughout that marathon, we talked about how historic and monumental her achievements are. So yeah, I mean, that's one of the thrilling things about this movie is watching Moss hit those heights.
Yeah, in terms of that performance and the camera work and the editing and the music and the overall sound design, and also just the structure of the film, which I'm sure we'll talk about, and the idea is that it doesn't explore so much as explode. For me, it's the most exciting, and by exciting, I mean unhinged, excessive, and intense film I've seen so far this year. It's number one for me right now, partly because while I was watching it, and this is a Sam Van Hallgren line, it just occurred to me, this is a classic Sam line, our producer and original co-host, I couldn't wait to rewatch it as I was watching it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sensation I had even 10 minutes into the film. I was ready to go back and appreciate this all again and take in a lot of those choices that I knew were coming at me so aggressively and intensely that I was being swept away by it, but maybe not even fully recognizing all that it was doing. And I think by the end of the film, you're probably able to see those full layers and the depth of this movie, but I can't wait to watch it again. And that's acknowledging just how maddening it is to spend any amount of time with Becky, and the way that he captures that, Perry, along with his DP, Sean Price Williams, who he's worked with, I think, on all of his other films, we basically don't get any escape. We are either right up in her face with those close-ups and that handheld camera, or they're employing the Steadicam that is following her around. As I said, she's stalking these rooms and these corridors, and the only time we're not being bombarded by her voice and her energy and her negativity is when she steps out of the room for a second and we get relative silence, and then she'll come right back in, and that sound wave and all that terrible energy just comes with her. And because they are shot not only with a Steadicam, but sometimes these long takes, you just have to exist in that space, just like all those people around her.
You're actually suing me, right? Or is that somebody else?
I'm suing.
I'll see you in court.
Judge! Your Honor! Is it a crime in this country to prefer the witching hour? I was born with an internal clock. A doctor left it inside me.
It's funny, I mentioned your first impression tweet. I saw that tweet probably 3 days before I finally watched the film. So I actually had completely forgotten about it. When I was watching the movie, despite all of the similarities to the Mabel character and Roland's in A Woman Under the Influence, I actually wasn't aware of it at all until a moment that happens about halfway through the film. It's really when she is at her rock bottom. It's right before it. And she's at a performance and she's 2 hours late and a camera crew is following her around inexplicably. Mm. You don't really know why, but she's clearly hired like some public access or some college crew to follow her around. And she's doing the Becky something thing she does. And then she huddles the group of performers, the women, around in a circle. And after giving them, I suppose, her best take on an inspirational speech, she just lifts one eyelid and quietly says, "Did you get that?"
Yeah.
Right? And that's the moment, just like the one in A Woman Under the Influence, that I think was either my favorite moment of that Cassavetes marathon or my most Cassavetes moment, one of the two. That part in A Woman Under the Influence when they're at that dinner table near the end of the film and poor Mabel says to Nick, her husband, "Am I doing it right?" They're both characters, that sense of performance. And granted, it's complicated here by the fact that she is an actual performer. Mm-hmm. And here there's the added layer of she's performing for the camera as well.
That's like Myrtle, right? A performer who's performing.
No, that's true, an opening night. But there are people who are aware of their personas. I think probably every moment of the day. In fact, they can't escape it. They're powerless to stop playing it, though. That awareness doesn't really matter. They're powerless, and they can't just be a person. And we see that certainly with Becky and her overall arc.
That's what's crushing her, right? In a lot of ways. And yeah, this film, another similarity with Cassavetes is it's interested in life as performance. Mm-hmm. It just happens to have, as opening night does, a performer as the main character. But you're right, A Woman Under the Influence is just as interested in life as a performance. Now, as far as Moss's performance goes, I've talked before on the show about how I love, she doesn't need dialogue, right? She's that skilled at expressions and using her face. And often, I think I've said like a smile from her rarely means she's happy. There's a use of a smile here early on where she's holding her baby, her toddler at this point, backstage, and she can at once smile and coo at the baby while out of the side of her mouth just ripping someone to shreds with an insult. Mm-hmm. And there's something monstrous and mesmerizing about that. And this is why we stick with her, right? We still get a sense of what's appealing about her. She's very witty. I mean, the lines that she's given from Alex Ross Perry, or whether some of these are improv, I don't know.
I don't think so. I think it was all scripted.
Probably. And they're really smart and funny and cutting. I'm thinking of the moment where she holds the door open for someone and just says, "Inward ho."
In the studio with those girls. Yeah. And it's inward ho. It's a great play on words.
In a play on words,
yes,
but also enthusiastic and cutting at the same time. Like it's as you were describing, it's kind of like bringing them closer to her so that she can devour them.
Right. And I think even after that look of despair goes from her face when she's watching them play their song, it turns into that same smile, that same monstrous, mesmerizing smile, I think.
Yeah. And the thing, did it ever strike you that she was almost a Shakespearean character in a lot of ways? Because there's a lot of crude dialogue here, but it has that, you know, Shakespeare's crude dialogue was also witty and smart. It was just using crudity to kind of disarm us.
Yes.
And she does something similar. Yeah. She gets a ton of monologues.
Yes.
And a lot of these just feel like these lengthy Shakespearean monologues. It's like the impression I got is it's like Lady Macbeth and her backup band is the witches. And I just loved watching her rule over these scenes this way, just go on and on and kind of keep us within the orbit by that intelligence, by the fierceness, even though you also see the insecurity right next to it,
totally
stalking her.
Yeah. Well, it's what makes her a fascinating character. She could be someone that we just want to write off and get away from. And it's not so much that the movie makes her someone who's sympathetic. She's not at all.
No.
I think that's a strength of the film, but she simply makes her someone who is complicated. And that's enough. That's enough. It comes through, I think.
She's sympathetic in as much as you recognize the addiction
yes.
element involved.
And that's
here.
A huge
and
part of her
clear.
Behavior. But I guess what I'm saying is Moss makes her human. Moss
yes,
makes her
yes.
human much more than just a character. And it's interesting that you bring up the Shakespearean aspect, because if you think about this film, and what first cued me into this actually was when I was reading a plot synopsis where it said that they're 90s alt rockers. And I went, well, of course they are. I got that reference to those kind of bands. I know L7 was one of them, those Riot Girls, Hole, of course. And
yeah.
you can't watch this and not think about Courtney Love.
I was thinking Veruca Salt.
Veruca Salt as well.
I mean, this is great music in here.
It is really
We should
good
probably
music.
Note real quick, Alice Bagnano penned the songs, at least the ones by Something She. I love them.
I do too. Some other artists I think are involved, including he's collaborated before with Keegan DeWitt, who does the sound design, which we touched on a little bit. And that's a huge, huge
yes.
part of this film. Keegan DeWitt, who also did the music for Hearts Beat Loud, a movie I love from last year and highly recommend. But it was jarring to me to read that, honestly, because if you think about the film, the way it's structured and the way it's shot, how confined it is, you really don't get any sense of what year it is besides the genre. It's a film that's so closed
that's
in
true.
And claustrophobic in a way that other than maybe paying attention to the clothes, it's the music alone that dictates the world. And I thought about how kind of theatrical it is in that sense too. These long sequences, these long acts almost. And the other real cue as to what Perry is doing with that structure comes at the end of, I guess, what would be the third act, which is that total self-destruction scene, the performance that
yeah.
goes wrong. It's when she hits that total rock bottom, as we've said. Do you remember how that closes? What would effectively be the intermission? Absolutely be the intermission.
Yeah.
Before we come back, Eric Stoltz, who plays her manager, mm-hmm. Howard, goes up on stage along with the drummer from the band, and they close
curtain.
A black curtain.
It's a literal curtain.
Slowly. Literally a curtain.
Yeah.
It's the time to go out into the lobby. Everyone go ahead. I'm surprised he didn't say go ahead and take a break and come back and watch the rest of the film, or didn't build in an intermission, because that's how deliberate it is in that structure.
Well, in between those lengthy segments, we should say as well, we get snippets of essentially home video flashbacks, even
right.
further back in the narrative in this band's story. And I got to say, this is your favorite film of the year so far. I don't have it quite that high, though I liked it a lot. I do have in the running an opening scene candidate for the end of this year. This home video scene of them seeing themselves on the cover of Spin. They're just mm-hmm. kind of breaking out, blowing up. And the way these three, the two other members in the band, are played by Agnes Dine and Gail Rankin, they don't quite know how to play this. And who are they watching for their cues? They're watching Becky, right? So at the same time that they're excited about it, they're trying to give the whole moment a punk rock sneer, right? Like, this is ridiculous. Who cares about the cover of Spin? And yet if you watch Becky's face, you can see that all at once, this is going back mm-hmm. to what Moss does without stating any of this. You can tell that they love it and hate it. They love that they hate it, and they hate that they love it.
Sure.
All of this is going on
yeah.
on her face at once, and they're following her every step. That's a great little snippet, more of an intimate style. It's grainier footage, obviously, and we get maybe three or four more of those. One of them actually is the crucial shift, I think, towards this other side of Becky, not the Becky something.
Not the persona.
Not the persona. We see a little video snippet of her at home. Her daughter is younger, so a newborn essentially, and balancing at once. She even says something about, I wish I could just stay home with my baby, and then notices, remembers she's being filmed. So she lights a cigarette and poses
yeah.
instantly.
It's the end of another performance.
It's there. The end of another performance, but it's also the first glimmer we've seen of the conflict that she's wrestling with, the regret she might have. And then gradually, as the movie goes on, we get a little bit more of that.
Mm-hmm. Back to that performance idea and the persona, I didn't have the chance I wanted to go back through my notes and really think about Queen of Earth or other Alex Ross Perry films. For sure, as we said at the beginning of the show, he mostly makes movies about terrible people or about people who are walking the line right there up against terrible, trying to navigate that terrain. But he also makes movies about artists in different ways. And I looked at my Queen of Earth notes and there's a line in the film. I think it's one of the Elizabeth Moss character's lines that says, "We should trade roles and see how we feel then." And that imbues every aspect of that film, this idea of playing certain roles, obviously. And the same way we talked about Mabel in, to go back to Cassavetes for a second, being a product of her institution in A Woman Under the Influence, the institutions being marriage, being middle class suburbia, being this woman who has to essentially sacrifice her individuality to the point that she no longer has any sense of self. Here, it's this institution that is rock and roll. It's the record business. And the way it explores that feminine angle here, it's explicit and yet at the same time very subtle because it's not discussed in those terms. There's never a point where she says, well, as a woman in this business, or ever goes down that path. And yet you can't overlook a scene like the one we've already talked about a little bit where she's in the studio and this new band walks in. When the guy from the record label sees that his former cash cow is no longer working out, he literally just goes out and finds three other women.
Replacement, yeah.
To imitate them. That's as easy as it is. That's how he can do it. They don't, as performers and artists, have that same luxury, and probably as performers and artists who are women have that luxury like he does. And I was just aware, I wonder, were you thinking about it all too, how we've seen this movie so many times before, whether fiction or especially nonfiction in terms of biopics, the self-destructive artist, the difficult, troubled artist. And of course, it's always men. And this film is not interested in doing what those movies so often try to do, which is showing the pain that somehow explains the psychology, explains the behavior, helps us rationalize or justify that behavior. It's also not interested really in supplying the pain at all. There are elements that come through these struggles as a female artist, as someone who is trying to figure out what being a mother is. We do meet her mother, played by Virginia Madsen, and there is some talk about their father leaving them and being alone and trying to navigate through that. But again, I think the movie just does it in a more incisive and, frankly, messy way than all of those other films do.
Yeah, messy is a good word for it, and that's a compliment to the film. I would agree.
Yeah.
There aren't these signposts that the music biopics give us, right? Like, this is what made him become this. I will throw out there two recent pictures, though, that tried to do something similar. I don't think either of them are as successful. A Star Is Born, which I liked well enough. Better music here. And also, more pointedly, Vox Lux with Natalie Portman, which came out at the end of the year, kind of in that rush. And
I was thinking about Blaze, the Ethan Hawke film.
Yeah, that one I have not
about
seen.
About the male troubled artist.
There's another male, yeah.
Still goes down that path in an interesting way.
Vox Lux, at least, you know, does focus on a woman. Eventually, the second half of that film really settles in on Natalie Portman and explores some of these similar things. I think overall, Vox Lux has it's almost too smart, trying to be too smart for its own good. There's a real disdain for pop music at its core that kind of cripples that film, in my opinion. So Her Smile is much more successful in upending this genre that we're talking about, and especially looking at it within the context of a woman's experience. You mentioned Queen of Earth, and there were some interesting uses of close-ups with the camera in that film, but I said earlier how much I like this in terms of a leap forward in filmmaking for Alex Ross Perry. You mentioned the cinematographer already, Sean Price Williams. What they do in these concert scenes, mm-hmm. where they get these bleary vertical shafts of colored light around the band, it's like they're going to get beamed up at any moment. I mean, it's not only thrilling visually and exciting to watch as concert footage, but it also helps us stick with Becky. And it explains to us why her bandmates stick with her. Because when they are on stage and things are working, it's electric. I mean, they're...
Yes.
Good.
Yeah, it's
they're
like they're
talented.
Literally affecting the molecules around them and the way that we see
perfect.
Color and light.
That is perfect.
Yeah.
And so we get why they're a big deal and why she's worth sticking with. Mm-hmm. We also get some interesting visual touches in that recording session, the disastrous mm-hmm. recording session you mentioned, before that younger band shows up and Becky's just alone strumming on the guitar, slumped on the floor. We see her through the pane of the engineer's booth and get both her – it's almost like her and the engineer, whose reflection we can see just his face of despair at this point. She's overextended her stay. They should have been out of the studio long ago. She yeah. hasn't produced anything. He's just sitting there, his face of despair, but it's almost like the two of them are in the same plane yeah. on the screen that just has this really beautiful, haunting quality. So that, on top of the structure of the film that we've already talked about, makes this really exciting from a filmmaking standpoint.
Maybe my favorite line in the film, and we can maybe close with this before a little bit of spoiler talk, and it gets to this whole idea of identity and her fractured sense of self and also her sense of grandeur and of delusion. When she says, and I think here she truly isn't aware, this is unironic, it's in some conversation in the midst of that meltdown in that third act, and she says, "That's why I named the band after me." Mm-hmm. And the band's name is Something She, and her persona's name, of course, is Becky Something. Something meant to sort of suggest this kind of elusive, enigmatic, hard to pin down, obviously. Yeah. Person, and yet she throws out there that, well, the band, of course, is named after her.
Yeah, and that makes it more specific and egocentric.
Exactly.
Right? That's what's happening in
exactly.
that moment. All right, so I wanted to ask you a spoiler question. So we'll give listeners a chance to jump ahead a little bit.
Maybe we'll play a little bit of music from the film here, Sam.
That would be great because it's fantastic music. All right, so I hope you don't ruin this for me, because what I really loved about the way this movie ends, and it is this extended sequence, a reunion concert of Howard's bands. We're not sure how farther down the line, but it is post-rehab for Becky. And from what we know when we meet her at the concert backstage, she's still clean. She's still sober. She's struggling with that. We see her walk past a dressing room. She's offered drugs.
Yeah.
She does her best to say no, kind of hangs around, watches, goes around the corner, hangs around some more. She's in tension there. And then for a few crucial moments, she disappears. And we're with some of the other characters. We're not sure what she's up to until it's time to go on stage. And she shows up at the last moment, kind of standing right at the precipice of going out the stage door. And she seems a little dazed. She seems a little unsteady. It could be the weight of the moment of actually having to perform without what gave her persona for so many years. Mm-hmm. Now, what I really loved is, unless I miss something, which is very possible, a detail or an explicit note that makes it clear, is I didn't know whether she had gotten high in some way or even taken a swig of beer or anything because she disappeared from the screen. And I loved that Perry made that choice to not tell us, because when we see her on stage and give another kick-ass performance – and sing a line like, "I don't want to quit, I just want to be in control of it," I love not knowing exactly what she means there, yet somehow it completely capturing the question this movie is really asking. Is that possible? Can you not quit but be in control of something like this level of stardom, this level of artistic success, this sort of art? Is that even possible to hold those mm-hmm. two things in tension? So
yeah.
I did ask Sam on Slack, because I knew he had already seen it, if he caught something I missed, either that she explicitly rejected taking drugs or if there was a hint that she did. His impression was it was ambiguous, but
right.
are you a little more sure one way or the other?
I strongly disagree. Yeah, and I'm someone who would normally embrace the ambiguity and suggest that's a real strength of the film. And I agree with everything you fundamentally said. You described it perfectly. And it's ambiguous insofar as you're right. He certainly doesn't tell us. And there's a ton of ambiguity and mystery about every aspect of the end of this film,
yeah.
which I love. There's something really almost scary about how this film ends, where when the characters, well, I caught on before the characters do, before the drummer says, "What did she mean by if this is the end?" I certainly thought in that moment with the girls that she is making amends and she is somehow coming to a conclusion. Mm-hmm. And she got the moment she needed.
Yeah.
She got some kind of resolution. And then honestly, she might not perform again. I did consider that instead of ending her life on stage, and she talked about this earlier.
Yes.
That she thought it would end that way.
She's
and
had
now
visions.
She's kind of, bad play on words here, she's kind of dodged a bullet, she suggests. Now it's not going to happen that way because I'm not going back on stage. So I thought, no, she's going to avoid it. She is in this moment going to maybe take her life. I'm just saying, I definitely thought that was a real fear.
And me too.
Just as they're walking through the halls going, where is she? Where is she? I'm going, where is she? Where is she? I can't believe they even let her out of their sight. So for sure, there's mystery and ambiguity. But I feel like Perry comes as close to spelling it out as he can with the very end of the film and with her last line. And I think one key distinction is we didn't talk too much about it in our review proper, but the addiction aspect of the film is huge. You can't overlook the fact that she's an addict. And that's another huge distinction between the behavior that she exhibits and Mabel in A Woman Under the Influence, right? She is driven in some ways by this. I mean, I would even
say Myrtle is a heavy, heavy drinker opening night.
You're right there. But thinking about that Mabel comparison specifically, there are times at her most manic and monstrous in her smell. I would say that Elizabeth Moss makes Jenna Rollins look like she's on a sedative. I mean, she is that big. And that's not really about the performance. I'm just saying
character. I get it.
In that way. The addiction is such a huge part of this particular character, Becky something, and to the movie as a whole. And yet, when she says, right before going out on stage to her bandmates, something like, I've never gone out there before exposed. I've never gone out there just as Becky. Yes, the fact that was shielded with drugs and alcohol was a key component of that, but I don't think it was the primary component. I think that was just part of it. I think that what she's saying there is, I've always gone out with that persona. I've always gone out as Becky something. I've never really admitted who I am. And we see in that one performance, her finally being the closest thing to her true self that she can be. And so at the end of the film, when she says, I'm done.
Yeah.
She says, no, I've given all
that's
I can
all
give.
I've got, something like that.
To me, that suggests she probably genuinely won't get up on stage ever again.
Yeah.
But it also suggests to me, to read it that way, I feel like you have to read it as though she didn't use. Because otherwise that blurs, that confuses the resolution, the epiphany that she has, that moment that she has at the end of the film where she says, I'm ready to walk. She can only walk away because she knows she did it without any aid.
She accomplished something new here. Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. So you're basically just arguing for one reading, which
I
like that reading. That's the reading I want. I was just basically, I was afraid I might have missed like a detail that suggested something more strongly. So I do still appreciate that ambiguity. I think you're right in making that comment before she goes out, though. Both those levels work. You know, the literal one that she hasn't gone out on stage sober before, but also in the more psychological level that you're talking about. I think both of those are probably true. And yeah, it's just, you know, even if that's where the movie leans, I'm so happy that it leans there slightly.
Me too.
And messily, and still makes you wonder and ultimately, you know, think of this shift, like really worry about her. And think about that shift from the first moment we meet her backstage to where we come, where we are worried about her here and how the movie got us there in a lot of very unconventional ways.
Yeah, I'll just throw in real quick because Sam brought it up to me as well. He mentioned the ending being like the ending of Born to Be Blue, which you'll recall one of my favorite films of a few years ago. And for people who haven't seen it yet, I really encourage you to do so. And I don't want to spoil the ending of the film, but I will just say, because it kind of adds to the context of this discussion, that there is a similar ambiguity and there's a similar choice the character, in this case, Chet Baker, the real life trumpet player, had to make as a jazz performer. There's this key moment at the end of the film where it's either finally him sober. He's going to be his true self. He's going to perform in front of Miles Davis. It's at Birdland. This is the realization of all his hopes and dreams. And is he going to do it as Chet Baker, or is he going to do it as the Chet Baker persona, the guy on stage who is always high on heroin? And this movie does have a similar choice that a character is very clearly having to make. It even has a very similar kind of moment. And this is where I know Sam's head is really leaning. I don't know if he actually sees it one way or the other, but certainly sees it as more ambiguous than I'm arguing for. We get a moment where we kind of see her behavior and that calmness and the otherworldly kind of stillness to her. It's easy to look at her in that moment backstage waiting and say, she's under the influence of something.
She does,
to take it back to Cassavetes.
She's a little zombified there, except we do also get that extended sequence of her alone at home post-rehab where the camera just sits quietly and watches her go through her calm morning tea routine.
Right.
She eventually gets visitors, and we see some of the old insecurities bubble up again, which is to the movie's credit. But we do get that little sequence of quiet and serenity. And so, again, love how the final moment combines that with also a little bit of the dazed sense of if she was under the influence.
It really does just undercut any type of redemption, though, to the end of the film, if you truly do see it as though she used, I feel like.
Well, and, you know, let's be honest, it's more of a Hollywood narrative that someone would go to rehab, be done, and they go to that reunion concert and they win. It's more realistic that maybe she slipped there. Maybe this is another step in her journey and that, this is not a moment of triumph. She used to get through this, but there's still a new self-awareness.
Yes.
And there could easily be redemption for Becky, even if she had used in that moment.
I don't see it that way. I don't think it can be. And I think that at the very end,
possible for her. I mean, she's still alive. She's still made a key character transition.
Yeah, but then she hasn't truly been herself, which has been the goal the whole time. And I think the only thing I would say to counter what you said about it being, you're right, it is. The whole fact that we even get a redemption sobriety narrative at all was a surprise to me.
Yeah.
And I do like how it played out because of the way Perry handles it and shows it, but it is more conventional and a little bit inspirational and cliche, but a way he subverts it, I think, is the more traditional way this would play out, whether fiction or nonfiction, again, would be that moment of triumph.
Yeah, clarity.
And they go on to have this amazing professional career because now they've finally broken through the moment of clarity. And in that moment for her to say, this thing you all want for me, that now I've figured it out and I'm ready to go back on stage and make money for people and be an artist again. She says, you know what? No, I've done the one thing I needed to do. I've come to terms with myself. I'm ready to now be completely detached from Becky something.
Yeah.
That's a more complicated triumphant ending.
It's definitely more complicated. And I also see that could be a choice on her part, recognizing, again, whether or not she did use there in that instance, that this entire life is not healthy. And there is awareness to that. She gets another mirror moment here in this scene.
For sure.
And so there are levels of recognition. So the fact that I've tried to come back to this, maybe I thought I could handle it now. And if she slipped up, if she relapsed, she still learned something there. And it would be tragic, but I don't think it would be damning.
Her Smell is currently playing in limited release, including here in Chicago, opening at the Music Box. Writer-director Alex Ross Perry will be in attendance for some of those screenings and for post-film Q&As. We will link to more details about that in our show notes at filmspotting.net.
It's the long-awaited return of Massacre Theater when we come back. I promise no more singing, plus the kickoff of our Stanley Donen Marathon with 1949's On the Town. Stay with us.
Woo, woo, woo! We're going on the town. New York! We're riding on a rocket. Woo, woo, woo! Gonna really sock it. Because tonight's the night. We're going on a toot. We're gonna raise a riot. The Brooklyn Bridge, we'll buy it. And hit the heights tonight. Get high as kites tonight. East side, west side, round the city. One day, one night, that's the pity.
A few quick thank yous to some listeners who have donated some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show, and a couple shout-outs. Here, Josh, I love doing these. Gina wrote in and said, could you shout out my partner, David Hagelgans? He's in Philadelphia. He would really appreciate it. He loves Film Spotting.
Well, hey there, David.
Yeah. Hey, David. Thanks for listening. Jeff C. also wrote in saying, this is for my wife's birthday. His wife's name is Suzanne. He says, thanks for the madness. And he also adds, thanks for helping me learn enough about film to be able to talk with my wife about this amazing media without feeling like a complete idiot.
We do what we can, Jeff.
We definitely do. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Suzanne, Gina, and David. And finally, Colin in Denver sent a donation our way. We'll hear a little bit more about that later in the show.
The world has changed. None of us can go back. All we can do is our best. And sometimes the best that we can do is to start over.
And Josh, you of course knew that that was Haley Atwell's Peggy Carter from the trailer for Avengers Endgame, but really from 2014's Captain America Winter Soldier, reused in the Endgame trailer. You know that because your daughter B is fairly Marvel obsessed, and you've been watching all these movies over time here, over the past year or so.
Yeah.
You've been taking in all of the MCU films again.
Since Infinity War came out, we watched them all again, getting ready for Captain Marvel, which has been fun. I think, you know what, Debbie and I missed one. The girls watched it while we were out of town.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Thor Ragnarok, so of course Debbie made me catch up with it.
Hemsworth, because, right?
Or
Waititi sense of humor.
If B is MCU obsessed, Debbie is Thor obsessed.
I get it. I think we all get it. Next week on the show, here's the point of all this. We're going to review Avengers Endgame. Will we get into some spoiler talk? We'll have to see. Maybe.
I would imagine. And what I'm most excited about Endgame, can I tell you, is that they're screening it at 11 in the morning. So that we have time to like get some food and maybe sit for 45 minutes or so before we start recording.
That's true.
As opposed to like, you know, the 7 p.m. screening, it goes for 4 hours. We get back to the studio and have to do a whole show.
Exhausted and beat and have to sound enthused and insightful.
So that's my personal concerns regarding Endgame.
Got it. We will also continue our Stanley Donen marathon with 1957's Funny Face, Fred Astaire, and that one along with Audrey Hepburn in Gay Paris. We will share our thoughts on the first film in the marathon on the town in just a moment. But Josh, we have to hear about your trip to Colorado. Ebert Interruptus, how WALL-E played for the crowd, how long it took you to get through WALL-E with people yelling out whenever they wanted to stop it and talk about it. Was it shorter or longer than Avengers Endgame?
Well, the total time we spent was probably a little longer. But, you know, that's the advantage of a 90-something minute movie. Over 4 days, we had no problem getting through it. Even had time to watch a little 2001, a little Hello, Dolly, and a little bit of Charlie Chaplin's The Rink. That's how we started things off. It was great. WALL-E held up perfectly, of course. Of course, I like it better now. Of course, you notice more things when you do this. And the really cool thing, this is part of the Conference on World Affairs, so we get to bring in other speakers, too. I managed to convince Michelle Thaler, who's works at NASA, to come and talk a little bit before one screening. Mike Reese came. He's a Simpsons writer, and there are more Pixar Simpsons connections than I even knew.
No kidding.
So he was able, a lot of writers have worked on Pixar stuff, so he was able to talk about that. So yeah, Ebert Interruptus, really, really good time. And I mentioned how many film spotting listeners showed up for part of that, but also for the meetup we had. The usual Coloradan crowd every year get to meet Jeremy Doan, Jonathan Anderson, and Scott Lunt, but also Libby Brown, who was, man, she's gone to Interruptus since the Ebert years and actually learned about film spotting through Interruptus.
Really?
Yep. So she showed up at the meetup, also invited me to come to her church and give a Movies Our Prayers book talk. Great meeting, Libby.
And you're like, I'm on the road. I got to go to church. Can't wait.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's exactly.
Well,
that's me, Adam.
You're promoting the book. I get it.
If it involves book promotion.
Yes.
Melissa was at the meetup. We tried to help her with a Denver University paper. This is what we did. This is how nerdy meetups are, Adam.
Only at a film spotting meetup.
She was writing about Westerns that involved atypical characters. And here's the really cool part, landscapes.
Landscapes.
So we spent some time on that. I doubt Melissa used any of my suggestions. I also want to note super fan listener Andy Wolverton. He came to Interruptus all the way from Baltimore, and even blogged about it. So we'll link to that in the show notes for those who want to learn a little more.
Yeah, you tweeted out a picture, and although it was a little bit blurry in the
of the meetup,
the basement of whatever bar you were in, it looked like a great crowd.
They were really good.
Was that your biggest crowd yet in Colorado?
Yeah, in Colorado for sure. I think we had like 17, 18 people, which is good. You know, there was like two tables next to each other, enough for everybody to talk. It was fun.
Yeah. Colin was one of the people at this meetup.
Yes.
And he sent us a pretty generous donation. He wrote, "Thanks for dinner and drinks Friday. I had a great time meeting the other folks in the area and Josh especially. So weird to have someone's voice in your head for 5 years and then meet them as a real person. There was an extra layer of weirdness on that front because I came to the final installment of Interruptus a little late, so the lights were down, and even though I knew Josh was theoretically somewhere in the room, I could still only hear his voice." Were you really even there? Was it just your detached voice from your body?
All right. Confession, I did it all through Skype.
Anyway, I owe you guys a lot more than this, but until the finances get on a more even level, I can't really swing much more right now. I can at least get you back for my share of the bill, plus a little interest. So did you tell, this is my only question,
yes.
Did you tell everyone there, should I be waiting for more to come in? Because you told them that this is our scam, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You buy them the food and drinks,
right.
But then at the end you say, "I'm just spotting you."
Yeah,
you have to pay us back with the donation plus interest.
Well,
we're gonna make money off these meetups.
We've been floating off that Seattle meetup for what, 2 years now?
Exactly. So while you were away, we had Scott Tobias in and we announced the winner of Film Spotting Madness 2019.
Indeed.
The best film of the 2000s. The top four seeds that Sam and I landed on for the bracket were No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood, The Dark Knight, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So we had those four movies in our minds predicted to
yes.
finish in that order. We knew that it would be a coin toss.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about,
you.
Okay, Anton, you got it? Okay,
yeah.
Good. It would be a coin toss between No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood, but we had to pick one to give the edge to. We thought the Coen brothers, being the Coen brothers and being the fact that they won
Madness
last year's
history.
Madness or a couple years ago, the directors, we thought for sure No Country would win. Turns out the number two seed took it. There Will Be Blood is the Film Spotting Madness champion. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was its challenger, so finishes in second place. No Country finishing third, taking out the Fellowship of the Ring in fourth place, which knocked out earlier in the tournament. The Dark Knight.
Crazy.
The Cinderella story, those hobbitses,
yes.
those nasty hobbitses, took down the Joker somehow in Film Spotting Madness. But how did you feel upon hearing the news that There Will Be Blood was victorious?
Which I actually heard at the meetup, believe it or not.
Okay.
Yes. As we mentioned, haven't seen High Life, still need to listen to the show. So the listeners informed me of that. And I mean, I'm okay with it. I love There Will Be Blood, but a little sad. A little sad. I think I would have liked to see Eternal Sunshine go all the way in this tournament. But that's okay.
That's fair enough.
You know what the listeners didn't tell me?
What?
Where did I ultimately place in our bracket competition?
I don't even remember the answer to that.
What? You don't win, so you don't even care anymore?
Nope.
It's like, if I'm not winning,
nope.
Let's not even talk.
I'm not going to give you room to gloat. I'm sure it's in the notes somewhere. You
listen,
can go back and listen to the show.
I just, come on, let's not be ridiculous. I just want to know I didn't lose. I think I was in good position
to
not
lose.
You didn't lose. Okay.
You didn't even come close to losing.
I can move on.
I'm the idiot who lost this time, and
I will
be punished.
That's why you didn't want to bring it up.
Maybe that's why.
What are you going to be watching?
That Adam Sandler movie, is it on Netflix yet?
I think it's, isn't it with Jennifer Aniston? Do I
Maybe.
Have that right?
That's what I'll be watching.
You know what, Adam? You let us know.
You know I will. I will probably take a year to watch it like you did.
You're going to watch this in 30-second increments.
I might. That's not a bad idea. I'll watch it like you guys watch WALL-E.
There you go.
Perfect. I'll interrupt the Adam Sandler movie. Just stop it frame by frame so I can really dissect it. Well, as we mentioned last week, and you didn't hear this, but I think you've probably picked up on these shenanigans through social media.
Yeah, you guys
we'll see.
You guys won't let
We're crazy.
Even a week breathe.
Nope.
You're
nope.
already on to
we
the 2010s.
We have to have some kind of stupid competition every week. We are already getting an early start on next year's Madness. Best of the 2010s. There's
yes.
been a pattern here. We mm-hmm. did the 1990s last year, 2000s this year, next year. We'll wrap up the 2010s as a decade. You'll probably see a bunch of retrospective lists on the top 10 or 50 or 100 films of that period. So then why not do Film Spotting Madness?
It'll
for
be
that
beautiful.
Period?
The symmetry. I
it
love it.
It should be. So listeners, I think after last Madness, the 1990s say, you know, it would be great if we could do our homework and be more prepared and have a good idea what movies might make the tournament so we could watch these films over the course of the year. A lot of teachers wrote in and said, you know, maybe before summer when we have that break
yeah, that
and we
sense.
Could watch some of these movies. So I think we waited actually until after January 1st this time, but we put out a list of like 80 movies that Sam and I felt pretty strongly we're going to be in contention for the final 64 of this year's Film Spotting Madness. And we're trying to get an even bigger jump on that. Just give people even more time. So sometime in the next few weeks.
This is what you could do in spring break
summer. We're going to throw a lot of films out there, probably about 100 films out there. And of course, yes, they're all not going to make the tournament, but they're going to be your top contenders. And in order to even get it down to 100, we've got to narrow it down a little bit. And we thought rather than just us forcing this on everyone, why not let the listeners partake? We're a democracy here, mostly.
Well, that's not true at all.
Yeah. Here on Film Spotting. So why not let you guys weigh in? We put up 4 poll questions.
Yes.
You can find these at filmspotting.net/madness. Help decide which movies will make the short list and may ultimately make the final list of contestants. We have an MCU battle, specifically an Avengers battle. And I did point this out last week, but maybe a little bit of confusion about it out there. So I'll specify here. There are going to be other MCU films in the tournament. This poll isn't deciding which one is going to make the tournament.
Was there an uproar about that?
No, but just a little bit of confusion.
Okay.
People were basically like, why are we picking just between an Avengers film? Because only one Avengers film is potentially going to make the tournament.
And fair. Actually, I'm glad to hear that because I wouldn't say either of these are the best of the MCU. So,
well, there you go.
I'm glad to hear there might be others.
There will
represent.
Definitely be others.
Good.
To represent at least one. But in the meantime, would you prefer The Avengers or Avengers Infinity War?
I personally would prefer The Avengers.
Okay.
Don't think it's great, but had less issues with that than Infinity War.
Now, two opposite subversions, if you will, on the superhero genre, Deadpool versus Logan.
Have not seen Deadpool, so I can't technically vote, but I really like Logan.
Okay.
So I have a feeling I'd go that way.
Fair enough. How about which of these two Star Wars movies? And look, Sam and I talked about it. Maybe they both belong in here, but for now, we're going to say, let's only pick one of them. I suppose we will see how good Episode 9 is this year and whether or not it should be in contention.
Yeah, that's true.
For best of the 2010s, but between these two, The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi, where are you going?
This is going to be unpopular, as most of my Star Wars opinions are, but like them both, had more fun at Force Awakens, loved meeting those new characters.
Okay, finally, Alejandro González Iñárritu. I didn't even have him in the top 100.
Of course you
didn't. Okay, that was my bias. But Sam pointed out, you know, he's got 2 Oscar wins in the decade. How are you going to overlook him completely? And he'd like to as well, frankly. He's probably not as down on him as I am as a filmmaker, but we're not going to put in both Birdman and The Revenant. You can only go with one. Which one is it going to be?
The one that made my top 10 list, because it's an amazing film, beautifully crafted, lots to think about. Could watch it again right now, The Revenant.
And of course, I went with Birdman. We want to know what you think. Help us narrow down this shortlist, filmspotting.net/madness. We do have another poll going on as we're getting back to our regular swing of poll questions. Every 2 weeks, we'll ask you a new one. You can find this one on the main page of filmspotting.net, and it relates to the MCU with Avengers Endgame coming out. We wanted to know what your MCU bona fides were. Basically, have you seen all of them? Have you reluctantly seen all of them? Have you seen some, or maybe just a few, or you don't even know what an MCU is? We would love to hear filmspotting.net.
I was actually surprised to see where this poll was heading when I went to vote myself. Now, I don't know. Have you seen, you've seen most of them, right?
Yeah,
have you seen them all?
I gave my answer as I have to vote somewhere in between all of them and most because I've seen all of them but one.
Oh, wow. Well, you got to do that. You've got, well, you're not going to do that.
I don't. No, I said pretty emphatically, I'm never going to watch Thor the Dark World. Debbie would have to come over to my house and make me watch Chris Hemsworth in Thor the Dark World.
Well, the next time you stop in, there's a chance it will be playing. All right, it's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a Film Spotting t-shirt. Let's give this a try.
No, no, Miss Lamont, round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
It is time for Massacre Theater. I don't know that we remember how to do this, but then again, we never knew how to do it in the first place.
I don't think being rusty is an issue.
Yeah, some bad acting here as we are going to try our best to perform a scene from a movie, and you have to just tell us what movie it comes from. There are a couple tie-ins to topics that we've discussed on the show already, but one notable one. I think that's all we'll say other than if you're listening to the podcast version, have kids in the car, you might want to pull out the earmuffs, but also we've softened the language a little bit.
Yeah, we've softened the language. There's also some content concerns here.
We're so family friendly.
Let's do it anyway.
Okay, you started off. I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
Let's try it.
And action.
I should have had you wear double condoms, but we shouldn't have done it in the first place. But if you ever do it again, which is a favor to women everywhere, you should not. But if you do, you should be wearing condom on condom and then wrap it in electrical tape. You should just walk around always inside a great big condom because you are shit.
Okay.
You should not be in contact with any living thing being shit.
Have you ever heard the expression, it takes two to tango?
F you.
Well, I could say we should talk about this when you're less angry, but that would be, when would that be?
F you.
And scene. You are not mad enough at me, Josh.
Really?
Not nearly mad enough at me. I didn't feel the rage.
Oh.
I really didn't.
There's a lot in there.
Well,
so
you did
surprising.
Not bring it.
Repressed.
So, if you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, April 29th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. F you! How's that?
That's much better. Maybe it's hard when you're saying F.
It kind of loses something.
It does, doesn't it?
It's a wonderful time.
Hey, fellas, what's the big rush?
We only got 24 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, we never been here before.
Ah, what can happen to you in one day? What do you think you're going to do?
New York, New York, a wonderful town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a wonderful town.
Gene Kelly, Frank Sinatra, and Jules Munchen in the opening scene from 1949's On the Town. Music by Leonard Bernstein. Well, somewhat. We'll get to that later, I'm sure. Directed by Stanley Donen and Kelly. Donen passed away in February at the age of 94. That's what inspired this marathon. Of course, both of us enamored with Singin' in the Rain. It's in the film spotting pantheon for good reason, but there are plenty of Donen films that we were ashamed that we haven't made time for, and it seemed like a perfect opportunity to remedy that with a marathon. That opening scene pretty much gives you all you need to know about this film. Navy men, Kelly, Sinatra, and Munchen are on 24-hour leave in New York City. They hook up with Ann Miller's Claire, Betty Garrett's Hildy, one of the best names maybe in cinema history. Her full name is actually Brunhilde Esterhazy.
Yes.
We'll call her Hildy. And Vera Ellen's Ivy. As you would expect, singing, dancing, and hijinks ensue. Now, as you would also expect if you've been following along with any of our recent film spotting marathons, you know that the professor, listener Nathaniel Myers at Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana, is going to come to our rescue and start off the discussion with a wonderfully smart and provocative voicemail. And that's what you're going to get now.
Hey, Film Spotting. Thrilled to be embarking on another marathon, especially one that, after Cassavetes, I hope will provide some slightly lighter fare. That was definitely the case with this week's film, 1949's On the Town, which was a collaborative effort between Donen and Gene Kelly. It's these two, of course, that only a few years later would go on to direct what is arguably the greatest musical ever made in Singin' in the Rain. And one element that I think On the Town shares with that later film is a sense of almost infectious exuberance, especially around some of its dance numbers. I had a lot of issues with Prehistoric Man as a song, but the dancing itself, especially by Ann Miller as Claire, the student of anthropology, was genuinely exhilarating.
No psychoanalysis, he never knew what made him tick. He never paid, it seems, for telling his dreams, poor prehistoric dick. Jitters! Jitters!
I found Miller, alongside Betty Garrett's indefatigable taxi driver Hildy, to be among the film's highlights. Ostensibly, the focus of On the Town is the three sailors, who have 24 hours to make the most of their time in New York City, played well enough by Kelly himself, Jules Munchen, and an incredibly young Frank Sinatra, who goes against type as a kind of naive and almost asexual out-of-towner. But it's Miller and Garrett who really drive much of the action and comedy. And it's not just that they're the savvy, progressive city dwellers to their male counterparts. I love, additionally, how attentive and supportive they are, as with Vera Ellen's Ivy, the love interest to Gene Kelly's character. even though they know that Ivy isn't anybody special, they go out of their way to keep the facade up, to protect her and the special romance that's forming with Kelly's sailor. Even as, and perhaps especially because, the future of the romance beyond that evening is uncertain. Now, with Donnan's recent passing, it's hard not to want to emphasize the positive elements of this film. But I'd be lying if there weren't a couple things that didn't work as well for me. Andrew Saris once said of Donnan that in some of his collaborative films, he lacked, quote, the stylistic presence of a Vincent Minnelli. And at least with regard to this film, I'd probably agree. Still, there are exceptions, like the great 360 pan over the city as the three sailors dance on the rooftop. And I know this film, too, is often lauded for helping to translate stage musicals into a cinematic experience, not least in its brief use of location shooting. So, where do you guys land? And were you able to consider the film without thinking too much about that landmark Donnan-Kelly collaboration that would, in 3 years' time, change film history forever? Thanks, guys.
Great stuff, as always, from Nathaniel. It's great to hear your voice again. It's great to be back doing a marathon. His final question there, were we able to think about this film and consider it without comparisons to Singin' in the Rain? I think I was. I watched it with my daughter, Sophie. I was excited about this marathon, excited to learn more about Donnan. And like our boys, like Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra and Jules Munchen, Sophie and I just wanted a good night out on the town. I was just looking to be entertained by this movie. And I have to say,
oh no.
That, yeah, you know that shot comes later in the film of Gene Kelly where he's sitting forlornly on the bar stool at the nightclub after Ivy runs out on him?
Yeah.
That was mostly me.
Adam.
Yeah, it was for most of this film. And I think it comes down to, Josh, the fact that it's hard to make a good musical with mediocre songs. And most of the numbers here are mediocre. I 100% agree about Ann Miller's dancing in the Prehistoric Man sequence. It's a wonder. And the energy of that and the skill on display there does almost compensate for how terrible that song is. Even if you somehow overlooked how antiquated and offensive it is, which
right.
really isn't possible.
It's not just that.
Yeah, it's still just a really bad song. And making matters worse, for me, it follows a mostly uninspired piece where we meet Ivy in a sort of Gene Kelly fantasy sequence. But I think the songs really are at the core of this. Again, most of the Leonard Bernstein stuff I learned later was cut from the original Broadway musical, and he basically boycotted this film. That wasn't a shock to me at all after watching it. I will say there's one key exception, and curiously, it's a non-Bernstein edition. I really loved the sweetness and gracefulness of Main Street, the song where Gene Kelly finally reunites with Ivy, finally finds her after this morning looking all over for her, and he walks her through what it's like back in his small hometown. We know, or think we know, what he doesn't at this point, which is that she's from the exact same town.
Come walking with me, I want you to see our Main Street. You'll know the whole town by just walking down our Main Street.
And so she, of course, is intimately acquainted with that type of life. And in that number, it doesn't have the same energy as a lot of the other tunes. It's not
as
manic
duet,
to go back to talking about her smell. But that's where the exuberance for me that Nathaniel touched on really comes through when they get to let loose a little bit and really hoof it in that song, but they're confined to that kind of pseudo studio space. They both just feel like they're ready to burst out of it. But there's also that little hint of melancholy and kind of wistfulness, this longing for this place that for both of them now is a little bit foreign. I mentioned kind of bursting out of that space. Gene Kelly's athleticism as a dancer is something too. That strength that he has is frankly sexy in a way that you don't get with someone like Fred Astaire. And I love watching Astaire and look forward to seeing him in Funny Face next week, but that's what really makes Kelly unique.
Yeah, for sure. Athleticism, I think, is the key to a lot of the successful numbers in this film. I think it is what Ann Miller brings to that Prehistoric Man number. You see it in what is just a beautiful sequence here. Main Street, very quiet, stands apart, you're right, but I liked it quite a bit. And you also see it in Miss Turnstiles, which is, it has that sequence where Ivy is essentially in an like an advertisement here. So she's running through these sports scenarios.
Yeah, that's the one that,
and
something about it didn't work for me.
Well, the music isn't great, but right. I did like, it fits into, which we'll get to, sort of the feminist undercurrents here in that the whole, all the sports scenarios involve her knocking out a series of male athletes. So I like that element, and the athleticism of those athletes, I think, is key. It's impressive what they're doing there. Okay, so about the music, a number of these pieces are composed by Roger Edens. And you might say, well, the Bernstein stuff is great, the Edens stuff isn't. And I don't think it's that simple, because Miss Turnstiles, we both just said, not great music, that's Bernstein. Prehistoric Man is Edens. Main Street, which we said we both liked, is Edens. And then one that really was kind of grating for me, Come Up to My Place,
yeah,
with Betty Garrett and Frank Sinatra in a car, is just, as I said, grating. Here's why. Here's the problem for me. The ones that don't work are the ones that really rely on a central shtick to drive them.
That's a good word for it.
So in Come Up to My Place, Betty Garrett is driving a cab, and every time we hit the chorus, you know, she slams the car down and Sinatra flies forward, and that's the repeated conceit of it.
My grandpa told me, Chip, my boy, there'll come a time when you leave home. If you should ever hit New York, be sure to see the Hippodrome.
The Hippodrome?
Yeah, the Hippodrome.
Did I hear right? Did you say the Hippodrome?
Yes, you heard right. Yes, I said the Hippodrome. Hey, what did you stop for?
It ain't there anymore. They tore it down, you know, a dozen years ago.
Oh, I wanted to see the Hippodrome.
It just, the music you need to get that across is not great music. Here's another thing. Because this is such a broad comedy, they're going for funny voices, not necessarily lovely voices. And I noticed this mostly when Sinatra finally got a chance to croon, and it was like sweet relief to hear someone of that quality. You're like, oh, wow, this is really nice to listen
because
to.
Because of the abundance of those types of voices and all the shtick that you would find this movie overall very grating.
Okay.
I'm surprised you didn't find it more grating than I did.
Let me make the shift, because I think the manicness that you've already talked about was something that bothered me in Minnelli sometimes. It is a factor I don't always go for. But there were a couple of things that really did win me over. And I would say it's not a musical classic of all the ones that I saw, but I did enjoy it. And one is that athleticism. And the other is I just didn't expect this movie to be this horny. And there was something
good way to put it.
Pretty amusing about that.
We're especially here. That it's coming from a woman.
That
mostly.
Is it.
Yeah.
That is it. It's 1949.
Multiple
I'm seeing
women.
These guys get off the boat and they start crooning like wolves, like they're going to hit the town. They're going to find a date. And little do they know, the women are waiting to pounce on them.
Right.
And there was just something really different and freeing about that. And we've talked about the main people who have this approach. It's Ann Miller's Claire Hudson. She's an aspiring anthropologist, and she's kind of sequestered herself in museums to keep herself because she can't resist men. And it doesn't work because the first guy she sees, essentially, she falls for, and that's Jules Munchen. I mean, the fact that she falls for him is key enough that she might have a bit of an issue here. And Betty Garrett is just delightful
she
as
is.
Hildy, the cab driver. Yeah. And to see how fun to see Sinatra as like this demure, shy guy who wants really nothing. He just wants to see the sights. And she
totally subverts your expectations.
Keep talking him into going up to a room. So the characterizations really work. I already talked about the feminist turn that Ivy is given. She's a little more reticent in the romance department, but she does get that sequence where she's knocking out the men. Okay, that's all great stuff. Really liked it. And I think it added a level of melancholy to this film that if it's aware of, it's way below the surface. And it has to do with this ticking clock time frame we're given. These guys have 24 hours. They're on shore and they're going to make the most of it. The women are going to make the most of it. And yes, it's sort of a conceit, but also at the end, you start to feel that as these hours slip away, the impending separation among this group, which they really do connect, you know, you start to feel that more. It looms over every joyous note, and it almost becomes existential. You know, it's something of a bittersweet reminder that all our days are numbered, and you're like, no wonder these women are moving so fast. You know, we've all got a limited time here, and I think the movie manages beneath all that that exuberance, which can feel forced in those numbers you talked about, I think there's just enough of that undercurrent to pull it back, at least for me.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I agree with you, even though I can't say in the moment that did occur to me. I did have another undercurrent that helped me along with this film that I'll get to in a moment. But first, to get there, I do have to go back a little bit to the location and the visual style. And you mentioned Minnelli. Nathaniel mentioned Minnelli, that maybe there's something lacking here. And I would say, yeah, you think? I mean, other than the flourish of Gene Kelly's dream ballet that we get, which is really fascinating when you realize what they're doing in that sequence, which is acting out the entire film just through ballet. No words, no dialogue.
Yeah, I'll get back to that.
Okay. I do appreciate that. But otherwise, we don't really get any of those moments. And I'm sure we're going to get them in this marathon at some point, like some of those wonderful camera flourishes and touches that we got with Minnelli. And look, there's something to say for restraint in musicals too, when a director realizes that it's more about the bodies in motion than the camera and really showcasing that skill. It's not on my part a desire so much for bravura camera movements, but I was looking for a moment or two of transcendence where the camera doesn't just capture the performance, but heightens the sensation we get watching the performance, or tells us something about the character or story we didn't otherwise know. I never got that here. Maybe some other viewers did. I was curious today how our friend and our resident musicals expert, classic Hollywood expert, Michael Phillips from the Tribune, felt about On the Town. And I asked him if he had any numbers in particular that he thought were memorable or really liked. And this is what Michael wrote back. He said, "The real and maybe the only reason the movie is historically noteworthy is the location work they managed to cram into a few days. So the entire New York sequence with all the sightseeing is really the best thing in it and maybe the only truly great thing about it." And Michael's probably correct. Now, I went back and read his obit of Stanley Donen, and he wrote this: "Along with Vincent Minnelli, who made his MGM directorial musical debut 6 years prior to Donen, the director showed the world how to activate song and dance cinematically. He tried things. Donen elevated a highly mobile camera and a film's editors to the status of valuable partners in the screen musical." I can't wait to see that, hopefully, in one of these other films, at least, that we're going to watch in this marathon. We didn't get it here, but that location note, that point about how it was kind of the first musical to break out of that studio lot mode and actually go on location in New York. What I loved about that is that it all ties back to this idea that's so central to this movie, which is fantasy. The space New York City occupies in the collective imagination, in a song like New York, New York, you get where you can do anything, you can be anything, where dreams come true. But that's something that's as much, if not more, myth than reality. And just like we get Ivy as Miss Turnstile, she's as much myth as reality. And that's a myth that Gene Kelly's character has bought into, and the other characters know the reality but let him continue to believe for his own good. You also get that wonderful bookend of The Longshoreman. His day, going back to that ticking clock, his day begins the same way. Maybe he's like Sisyphus, to get philosophical, who's pushing that boulder every day. It's the same exact routine, showing up at that job. And there's a mundanity to it for him, this life in New York. But every morning, just like we see at the end, there's a new batch of sailors.
I love that touch.
Yeah, who can't wait to indulge, hopefully, all of their fantasies. So there's this aspirational quality to New York that's what it is almost always in the movies, tinged with a little bit of loneliness and still a sense of isolation amidst all those people and disappointment that maybe you're not living up to that fantasy. We certainly see that with the Ivy character, but all of these characters, including the women, they're all in pursuit of something. And I think reconciling your dreams with reality, going back to Ivy, are you that big city girl that she seems to aspire to be? Or in your heart, are you that small town girl? Are you like the Ann Miller character? Are you this scientist or are you this lover? Is it more primal or are you this intellectual or are you both? That reconciliation is at the core of this movie and I think a lot of musicals. So I did appreciate that.
I do love that touch that the new batch of sailors comes out of the ship at the very end of this movie, even though it does undercut the ticking clock element of it. You know, it's like, hey, things just start over again.
Right.
You've got another shot. So maybe that's why they put it there at the end. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, in terms of Minnelli, I know in his biographical dictionary of film, David Thompson writes glowingly of Donnan, and I don't know where he would place him in comparison to Minnelli, but he does bring up Minnelli and kind of emphasizes that same location element, how Donnan was really one of the first to experiment with that and to move that forward. We see a bit of it here, but maybe we will see more and get a sense of how he contributed on that end. But one thing that I think is a real strength of this film is that experimental third act fantasy sequence where Kelly Saylor imagines he sees the poster for a musical number that it's essentially telling the same story he's just lived. And as you said, we get this without singing reenactment of the movie up to that point. And there's a ton of athleticism there. It basically involves him and Vera Ellen. They're the two performers who carry over. But then we get a whole new troupe of background dancers. And they use silhouette in this. There's obviously music and just all sorts of fascinating movement. And I found this to be a more effective meta touch of something Donnan and Minnelli would also employ later. I mean, you know, think about Singing in the Rain, these sort of extravagant, over the top, flowing outside of the fourth wall, over the fourth wall musical numbers that in some instances I found overwhelming. But here there's something about the delicacy to it and the quiet to it that it feels, rather than an eruption the movie is building mm-hmm. to, but an interlude that really extends it and opens it up in different interesting ways.
Yeah, maybe a little bit more contemplative almost.
Very contemplative.
Plaintive. Yeah. I think that works. I agree.
You like that.
I was really
okay, good.
A fan of that sequence as well. I was surprised by, and maybe there's a good explanation for this. Maybe this is fairly common in films at this time, and I am just not aware of it. But did you notice how pop culturally aware the film was? All the references to other films, for example, in the movie, they mentioned The Lost Weekend. They mentioned A Streetcar Named Desire, which Sam pointed out to me would have been just a play at the time this movie came out, not a movie. They talk about Dinah Shore, Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Yeah,
and then
that's true.
My favorite line in the film, not a movie or a play, but another popular platform at the time, we get the moment where we have just met, I think, at the museum, the Claire character, Ann Miller's character, who has the hots, as you pointed out, for the Jules Munchen character. And she says, I was just doing a bit of research, and it goes by so fast, but Hildy says, Dr. Kinsey, I presume?
Yeah, I heard that.
Right? So again, that would have been a very popular book at that time.
Yeah.
It would have been in that public consciousness, and the movie is tapping into that. Maybe that's just part of commercial art at the time to have those kind of signposts for people.
Yeah, a lot of the one-liners do rely on that sort of stuff. To circle all the way back to Nathaniel's opening question and, you know, how Singing in the Rain, the other Kelly Donnan collaboration might have loomed over this, I didn't really have that issue either. I think maybe because fresher in my mind is Hello Dolly for Wally Interrupt Us. We watched a little bit of Hello Dolly. I watched it for the first time myself a few weeks ago, and that's directed entirely by Kelly. I don't know if that would work better for you. There are some very elaborate crane shots in there that Kelly employs that make much more use of space and the filmmaking grandeur. But yeah, it's just interesting to think about this marathon. And I don't think we are going to watch another collaboration between the two of them.
I don't think that's on the lineup right now.
Marathon. But it's just worth pausing and, you know, noting how crucial and how longstanding this was with Donnan beginning as a backup dancer alongside Kelly on Broadway, became a choreographer and then working his way up to being co-director with him. So it's just an interesting creative partnership, different from what we've encountered in other marathons, and kind of sussing out, you know, especially when we look at the auteurist stuff, like whose hand is what and what did actually Donnan bring. Maybe that will become clear as they separate.
Yeah.
And we see something other than Singing in the Rain and On the Town, which we're going to do next.
Maybe so. You mentioned past marathons and other collaborations. Of course, my mind goes to one ages ago that you weren't part of very early in the show's history, Klaus Kinski and Werner Herzog. And in reading Michael Phillips' Obit, which I'll link to in our show notes if you want an easy way to check it out, he talks about Donnan and Gene Kelly as collaborators, and it's much more Kinski and Herzog than you might think. I certainly had no sense of it, but they had big egos. They fought a lot. Obviously, they produced great work. Maybe it wasn't quite the case like with Kinski and Herzog, where one tried to kill the other, allegedly, but they were at it a lot, which fascinated me.
Interesting. And, you know, there wasn't that element, but thinking about an actor-director collaboration, of course, we just did that with Cassavetes and Jenna Rollins.
Yes, of course. On the Town is available to rent or stream on most platforms, or, of course, you can get it probably from your local library. We would love to hear your thoughts. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. It's Fred Astaire up next week with Audrey Hepburn in 1957's Funny Face. More information about this marathon and all of our past marathons can be found at filmspotting.net/marathons. And Josh, that is our show.
Indeed it is. Over at filmspotting.net, you can also find 14 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. And that's where you can vote in the current Film Spotting poll. We're asking, how many MCU films have you seen? Also, if you haven't already, please do check out our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show. Right now, it's part one of their Little Big Guys pairing. So they're going to be talking about 1988's Big this week. Next week, they'll look at Shazam.
Yeah, which you listened to the show, so you didn't hear the part where Scott and I talked about how charmed we were by it. I definitely think you need to see it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I got to fit that in along with all the MCU stuff too, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's better than a lot of those MCU films.
I believe it. To order Film Spotting t-shirts or Film Spotting merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And if you want to interact with us on social media, find Adam at Film Spotting and I'm at Larson on Film. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Also, if you want to subscribe to the weekly Film Spotting newsletter, you can do that at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Okay, maybe not a lot of them, but definitely some. It's better, definitely, than some of the MCU films.
Give me a Letterboxd star rating for Shazam.
I was 3.5 on it.
Ooh.
And considered 4.
Wow.
Yeah, because I really liked it. So I had to at least think about it. Out in wide release this weekend, Breakthrough, which stars Topher Grace and Josh Lucas, The Curse of La Llorona. Ignoring the eerie warning of a troubled mother suspected of child endangerment, a social worker and her own small kids are soon drawn into a frightening supernatural realm. And finally, Penguins. I love what Sam, our producer, did here. He puts in brackets next to the titles, the plot description, and next to this one, it just says Penguins.
What more could you need?
You don't need anything else.
You know, I bet you for sure The Curse of La Llorona would be better if it also had Penguins.
If it has any Spanish in it, I know you'll think it's the best film of the year.
Nice.
Going really inside baseball with that Josh joke there. Next week, we've touched on it. Not only will we have the second film in our Stanley Donen marathon, but we will review the new MCU film, Avengers Endgame.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Andy Mitchell. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.